and tropical light confuse him. The tan of the sand and azure sea, the dry mountains ringing them in. He squints at the vegetation, so lavish. He has never paid much attention to plants. He never had time in his life to learn them, and now he never will. They walk down a path alongside trunks that open into giant, gnarled parasols against the sun.
What on earth, Nile? Your sci-fi?
As if his son's pulp magazines still gather dust balls in stacks under the boyhood bed.
No, Peter. Earth. Dragon blood trees. They're real? Trees like that in our world?
The beggar smiles and points. Everything based on a true story. It dawns on the blue god. The fish in these seas, the birds in the air, and all that creeps on this made earth is just a crude start for some future refuge, saved from the vanishing original. He walks up close to one of the monster toadstools.
What can the players do with this place?
The words spill out of the beggar, unplanned.
What do you want it to do, Dad? Ah, Nile, I remember. Good answer.
The beggar describes just how large the sandbox is. A person can gather herbs, hunt animals, plant crops, cut trees and fashion boards, dig deep mines for minerals and ore, trade and negotiate, build cabins and town halls and cathedrals and world wonders. They walk again. The climate changes to something lusher. Beasts prowl in the undergrowth. Above them, flocks wheel.
When do people start to arrive?
End of next month.
I see. Soon.
You'll still be here, Dad.
Yes, of course, Nile. How do I nod again?
The blue god learns to nod. So much new to learn.
What happens then?
Then, we get flooded. 500,000 have signed up already. $20 a month. We're planning for a few million.
I'm glad to see it like this before.
Yes, just the two of us.
The novice Vishnu stumbles up the trail. They have mountains to cross now, vine-covered canyons. The god stands for a moment, awed by his surroundings. Then he wanders down the forest path again.
Only a quarter century, Dad, since we wrote that Hello World program, and the curve is still heading straight upwards.
From 2,000 miles apart, for a few trillion cycles of the processor's clock, a processor descended from the one the blue-skinned god helped build, father and son look across the mountains together and into the future. This land of animated wishes will expand without limits. It will fill with richer, wilder, more surprising life beyond life. The map will grow as full as the thing it stands for. And still, people will be hungry and alone. They walk along magnificent crests. Far below, a wide old river meanders through a jungle dense with many greens. The blue god stands and looks. All his life, he has been homesick. Yearning drove him from a village in Gujarat to the Golden State. He has had no country except for work and family. And all his life he has thought, it's only me. Now he looks down on the snaking river. Millions will pay a monthly rent to come here. And he'll be gone.
Where are we now, Nileji?
It doesn't work like that, Dad. All brand new.
Yes. No. I understand. But these plants and animals. We've walked from Africa into Asia?
Follow me. I'll show you something.
The beggar leads them down a switchback into the thickening jungle. They enter a maze of twisty trails all alike. Creatures dart through the undergrowth.
Neem trees, Nile. Magic!
Wait, there's more. The jungle thickens and the trail thins. Shapes play in the fronds and creeping vines. Then the father sees it, hidden in the foliage of this sprawling simulation. A ruined temple, swallowed by a single fig.
Oh, my prince, you really made something.
Not just me. Hundreds of people. Thousands, really. I don't even know their names. You're in here, too. The work you did.
The beggar turns. He waves at the roots that snake across the ancient stones, looking for cracks to slither into and sip from. He raises the tip of his gnarled pinky.
You see, Peter, all from out of a seed this big.
Vishnu wants to ask, how do I make my eyes water? Instead, he says,
thank you, Nile. I should go now.
Yes, Dad. I'll see you soon.
It's a harmless enough lie. In this world, the beggar has just walked across half a continent. But in the other, he's too frail and wasted to risk an airplane. And the blue god, who has just crossed a jagged mountain range in bare feet, in the world above, his body is so riddled with rogue programs and syntax errors, he won't make it to this world's opening day. His puppet body nods, and his palms join together.
Thank you for this walk, dear Nile. We'll be home soon.
From enlightenment to the damburst in Ray Brinkman's brain takes 13 seconds. The bedroom television blares the nightly news. Israeli forces are plowing up Palestinian olive groves. Beneath the quilt, Ray squeezes the remote, boosting the sound enough to drown out thoughts. Dorothy's in the bathroom, prepping for bed. Her nightly ritual graduates from one noise to another. Blow dryer becoming electric toothbrush, becoming water coursing into the ceramic basin. Each sound says night to him, the way wolves must have once, or the calls of a loon. And like the calls of those animals, these sounds, too, will soon disappear. She takes forever. And for what? After this night's catastrophe, which of all these preparations couldn't she do to more purpose in the morning? She'll be clean for sleep, and ready for anything night might bring, though night can bring no worse nightmare than day already has. Nothing makes sense to him. After this evening, it's unthinkable that she'll climb back into the bed of their last dozen years. But it's even more unthinkable that she'll sleep down the hall, that room she once, so many years ago, dreamed of converting into a nursery. He'll destroy this bed, chop the carved oak headboard up for firewood. The newscaster says, meanwhile, other trees in schoolyards all over Canada are being cut down to protect the lives of children after... Ray regards the screen but can't make out what he's seeing. That happens in seconds 1 through 3. He thinks, with what is still coherent thought, I've been a man who happily confuses the agreed-on for the actual, a man who has never doubted that life has a meaningful future. Now, that's done. These thoughts take less than another quarter second. His eyes shut a moment, and he's auditioning. Their first date. The witches tell him to take no care for tomorrow. He's beyond all harm until the forest gets up and walks for miles, until the woods climb up the side of a faraway hill. He's safe, safe from now on, for who can impress the forest or bid the tree unfix his earthbound root? Our high-placed Macbeth shall live the lease of nature. But he was given another part. The man, not of woman born, who makes the woods move. Ray's eyelids close for half a second. On the insides of those living screens, he watches the two of them sleep together, the night of their first venture into amateur theater. All our yesterdays, over and over. The baby Lady Macbeth, no more than 24, fretful in the foyer of adulthood. His high-strung friend, alongside him in the dark, barraging him with an anxious job interview.
How do you feel about your parents? Have you ever had racist thoughts? Did you ever shoplift?
Even then, on night one, he saw how they would take care of each other into old age. The two of them, following a design laid out long in advance that promised to explain itself in the run of time. Forever. And forever. And forever. The prophecy was a trick. He must pick himself up and live. But how? Why? The news cuts to a wild scene. Ray watches in a fog. People locked down and police culling them. The stream of water in the bathroom stops. These are seconds 6 and 7. Every belonging turns into theft. That's what his wife told him just an hour ago.
You think this will all blow over and I'll come to my senses? That I'll turn back into your quirky little dot?
He tried to say that he's known for months, for a year and more, that he's still here, still her husband. Come and go, be with whoever, do anything, just stay near. Worse than theft, murder.
You're killing me, Ray!
He tried to remind her. Something between them has yet to happen. A reason why they must stay together. He has seen it already, a premonition that has kept him going all these months of holding still. Some purpose to their union that already always existed. They belong.
No one belongs to anyone, Ray. You need to set me free.
Something is happening in the bathroom, and everything that sounds like nothing. 2 seconds of silence, and he's terrified. Nothing makes sense. There's nothing to take care of. He looks back at the television. People are taking it in the eyes for nothing, for no use at all. In seconds 9 and 10, his brain turns into a circuit court. It fills with a thought that he first had months ago, reading one night while his lawful wife was off getting her brains fucked out in would-be secrecy. A thought he has stolen from someone else's copyrighted book, one that he must now pay for. Time alters what can be owned, and who may do the owning. Humankind is utterly wrong about the neighbors, and no one can see it. We must repay the world for every idea, every thing we have ever stolen. The people on the screen begin to scream. Or maybe the sound comes from him, watching himself turn brown and fall. She's in the doorway, shouting his name. His lips move, but they make no sound. It's like I had the word book, and then you put one in my hands. He slides from the bed onto the pine floorboards. His eyes land flush up against the whirlpool grain. A thing in his brain breaks, and everything that was once as safe as houses collapses like an overdug mine. Blood floods his cortex, and he owns nothing. Nothing at all but this. A man stands by her desk in a taupe serge suit when Mimi arrives at 7:30 on Monday morning. She knows at a glance who the stranger is. Miss Ma. Flattened cardboard boxes lean against her desk. He has been here for some time. His job depends on getting there first, to ensure there will be no problems. Her computer has already been unplugged, and all the cables wound up in neat spools on top of the CPU. The files are long gone, removed while she was having coffee and a bagel a mile away.
My name is Brendan Smith. I'm here to assist your transition from the company.
She has known this would happen for days now. She's been all over the news. Criminal trespass. While her fellow engineers might overlook that error, the species is plagued by countless design flaws, after all. She's also guilty of fighting against progress, freedom, and wealth. The race's birthright. That's not something her profession will ever forgive. She stares at her professional ejector until he looks away.
Gareth thinks I'm going to trash the place? Steal some international ceramic molding secrets?
The man assembles a carton. We have 20 minutes to fill these. Personal items only. I'll inventory everything you want to take, and we'll get it approved before you sign out.
Sign out? Sign out?
Rage comes up her throat, the rage that this private escort firm has been hired to nullify. She turns and heads toward the door. Taupe Boy stops her just short of force.
Once you leave the office, we will consider it sealed.
She wavers and sits at her desk. Not her desk. Her brain feels maced. How dare they? How dare anyone? I'll sue for everything they're worth. But all the rights and privileges of fair practice are theirs. Humankind is a thug. The law is a goon. Her colleagues pass her door, slowing just enough to catch a glimpse of the drama before slinking away in embarrassment. She puts her books into a box her minder has made for her, then her notebooks.
No notes. The notebooks are company property.
She fights the urge to hurl the stapler. She wraps her pictures in the paper her minder gives her and boxes them. Carmen and her Kentucky Mountain saddle horse. Amelia and kids in the swimming pool in Tucson. Her father, standing in a stream in Yellowstone. Her grandparents in Shanghai, in their Sunday finest, holding up the photo of American girls they would never meet. Logic puzzles made of bent nails. Framed funny sayings.
Reactions speak louder than words. Some see the glass as half empty, some as half full. An engineer sees a containment device twice as big as it needs to be.
Are you finished? Her personal early retirement officer says. A suitcase covered in pennants, a steamer trunk stenciled with a foreign name.
Your keys.
She shakes her head, then hands over her corporate keys. He checks them off on a list that he makes her sign.
Please follow me.
He takes the boxes. She grabs the suitcase and steamer trunk. In the hallway, curious colleagues skitter away. He sets his boxes down and locks the door. The moment the lock clicks, she remembers.
Shit! Open back up!
The office has been sealed.
Open it!
He does. She re-enters the room, goes to one wall, and gets up on a chair. She removes, foot by foot, the 1,200-year-old scroll of Arhats on the threshold of enlightenment, rolls it up, and pockets it. Then she follows her escort to the front entrance, past the staff who greeted her warmly for years and who now attend to their pressing work. As she shuttles her accumulated professional life to the parking lot, the man posts himself at the firm's door. Like the angel at Eden's east gate who kept the humans, poachers of one forbidden tree, from breaking back into the garden and eating the other fruit that would have solved everything.
The only animals that know they're hosed. That,
Dougie keeps saying, near midnight over blaring headbanger anthems in a roadhouse full of off-duty militia and other armed patriots,
that's where all the trouble starts. I mean, how does knowing you're going to die give you a leg up? Smart enough to see you're a sack of rotting meat wrapped around a little sewage tube that's going to give out in, what, another few thousand sunrises?
His fellow philosopher seated next to him at the Satinwood bar replies,
"Could you shut the hell up for a second?" Now, a tree. Those guys know things on a scale and time frame we can't even...
A fist flings out and meets him in the cheekbone, so fast it's like Douglas is frozen in place. He hits the fir floorboards head first and is out so fast he doesn't even hear the man stand over him and deliver the eulogy.
I'm sorry, but you were warned.
When he comes to, his pal Spinoza is long gone. He daubs at his head and face with tentative fingertips. Nothing's missing, but there's a mushiness that doesn't feel quite right. Stars and lights, dark clouds and pain, though he has lived through worse. He lets the concerned waitress help him to his feet before shaking free.
People are not what they seem.
This time, no one voices any opposition. He sits in his vehicle in the roadhouse parking lot, working his unplanned plan. He has, to the best of his knowledge, no one to go to for aid and comfort, except his partner in world salvation, the woman who has joined him to a cause bigger than mere doomed Pavlicekism. She alone knows how to take him and give him purpose in this life. It's pushing a boundary to drop in on Mimi at this hour. Though she has never expressly forbidden him to come over at night, she's not going to be thrilled. Still, she'll know what to do about that mess, his face. She told him once, when they were chained together for tedious hours across a stretch of road that it turned out even the lumber companies weren't all that interested in, about her great and youthful loves. Both sexes, no less. That disclosure, plus a feather, could have knocked him out. He's down with whoever she might want to be. The world depends on so many different species, each a nutty experiment. He just wishes she'd let him into the inner sanctum sometime, trusted confidant, her manservant or something. Wishes she and whoever may be her life's current answer might let him watch over them, a sentry against the malevolent world. He struggles to fit the key in the ignition. He's probably not to be trusted with heavy machinery, but his cheek is loose, and something's oozing out the side of his eye. Nowhere else to turn, really. He noses out of the lot and back up the valley highway toward town and love. He doesn't see the truck pulled over on the shoulder outside the bar. Doesn't see it edge onto the asphalt behind him. Sees nothing until two white eyes fill his rearview mirror and the beast smacks his rear bumper. He shudders forward, fishtailing. The truck looms up and rams him again. He can't brake, can't even think. The road dips. He gooses the pedal, but the truck stays with him. At the hill's bottom, he skims over a railroad crossing, catching air. A crossroad swims toward him. He power skids into a sudden right at twice the speed of a controlled turn. In slow-mo slalom, his rear swings clean around, 270 clockwise. By the time he comes to rest, he's in the intersection, perpendicular. As the empty logging truck slams down the highway, the driver laying into its horn a long blast goodbye. Douglas idles in the intersection, freaking. The attack putties him worse than anything the police have done. Worse than when his plane went down. That was just God at his usual roulette. This is a crazy man with a plan. He carries on down the crossroad the long way back to town. He can't keep off the rearview mirror, where he expects the twin white beams to swim up again at any moment. But he makes it all the way to Mimi's condo without further incident. The light is still on at her place. When she opens the door, it's obvious she's drunk. Behind her, the room is trashed. A scroll unrolls across the living room floor. She wobbles and slurs, "What happened?" He touches his face in surprise. Forgot all about that. Before he can answer, she pulls him inside. And that's how the trees bring them home at last.
Adam Appich puts his right foot into an imaginary niche and steps up. Slides the rope's slipknot. Steps again with his left. Fights to forget how many vaporous steps he has already taken. Tells himself, I used to climb trees all the time. But Adam isn't climbing a tree, he's climbing the air. On a rope as thin as a pencil, dangling from a trunk so wide he can't see both edges at once. The furrows in its foot-thick bark are deeper than his hand. Above him, a long brown road vanishes into cloud. The rope starts to spin. A voice from on high says,
Wait! Don't fight!
I can't do this.
You can! You will, sir!
His throat fills with reflux and dread. Foot by foot he closes the impossible gap. Near the top he dares to look up. Two arboreal creatures speak soft encouragements he neither hears nor believes. He reaches something solid, still breathing. Not well, but breath.
See?
The woman's radiant face makes him wonder if he didn't die somewhere on the way up. The man, clotted skin and Old Testament beard, hands him a cup of water. Adam drinks. He's a while believing he'll be okay. The platform under him tips in the wind. The tree couple hover, offering him berries.
I'm good.
Then, I suppose that would have been more convincing if I'd said it 5 minutes ago. The woman called Maidenhair scampers up a limb to the makeshift pantry, looking for a tea that she claims will help his vertigo. She's attached to nothing. Barefoot, 20 stories up. He buries his face in the needle-stuffed pillow. When he's able, Adam looks down. Patchwork slop spreads through the forest below. He has passed through the massacre up close, smuggled in by the messenger Loki. But this bird's-eye view is worse. The longest, most resolute tree sit in the area, manned by the ideal subjects for his study of misguided idealism, is the last large remnant spared by the harvest. Scattered stands dot the bald patches, like the tufts missed by a teenage shaver. Fresh stumps everywhere, slag and burnt slash, refuse sprinkled with sawdust, the occasional trunks left in ravines too steep to bother with, and a clump circling the great tree that these sitters call by name. The man, watchman, points out the landmarks. All that loosened topsoil is washing down this face into the eel, killing fish all the way to the ocean. Hard to remember, but when we came, 10 months ago, everything was green as far as you could see. So much for trying to slow things down. Adam is no clinician, and 250 interviews of activists along the Lost Coast have left him gun-shy about diagnoses. But Watchman is either deeply depressed or a born-again realist. A flare-up far below. The hornet buzz of heavy machinery, and Watchman bends to look.
There!
Yellow, brighter than a banana slug, crisscrossing a half a mile away in the dissolving forest.
What do we have?
Maidenhair asks. Skyline yarder. A couple of grappler cats.
We could be sealed off by tomorrow.
He looks at Adam.
You may want to ask whatever you want to ask, then head back down tonight.
Or join us, Maidenhair says. We'll put you up in the guest room. Adam can't answer. His head is still crushing him. Breathing makes him ill. He just wants to be back in Santa Cruz, analyzing the data from his questionnaires and drawing dubious conclusions from ironclad statistics.
You're more than welcome, the woman tells him. After all, we only volunteered for a few days. And here we are, almost a year later.
Watchman smiles.
There's a beautiful line of muirs. I only went out for a walk.
The contents of Adam's guts spill through the air, 200 feet down to earth. The subjects sit on the platform, gazing at the questionnaire and the pencils Adam gives them. Their hands are stained brown and green, with crusts of duff under their nails. They smell ripe and musty as redwood. The examiner has gotten himself above them in the lookout hammock, which won't stop rocking. He studies their faces for the strains of paranoid salvationism he has seen in so many of the activists he has already interviewed. The man, capacious yet fatalistic. The woman, self-possessed in a way that no one getting hammered so badly has a right to be. Maidenhair asks, "This is for your doctoral research?"
"It is."
"What's your hypothesis?"
Adam has been interviewing for so long, the word sounds alien. "Anything I say might affect your answers."
"You have a theory about people who..."
"No. No theories yet. I'm just gathering data."
Watchman laughs, a brittle monosyllable.
"That's not how it works, is it?"
"How what works?"
"The scientific method. You can't gather data without a guiding theory." "As I've told you, I'm studying the personality profiles of environmental activists."
"Pathological conviction?" Watchman asks.
"Not at all. I want to learn something about people who believe that plants are persons too?"
Adam laughs and wishes he hadn't. It's the altitude.
"Yes. You're hoping that by adding up all these scores and doing some kind of regression analysis..."
The woman fingers her partner's ankle. He hushes at once, in a way that answers one of the two questions Adam wants to sneak into his questionnaire. The other question is how they shit in front of each other 70 yards in the air. Maidenhair's smile makes Adam feel fraudulent. She's years younger than he is, but decades more certain. "You're studying what makes some people take the living world seriously, when the only real thing for everyone else is other people. You should be studying everyone who thinks that only people matter."
Watchman laughs. "Talk about pathological."
For an instant, above them, the sun pauses. Then it starts its slow drop westward, back into the waiting ocean. Noon light washes the landscape in gilt and watercolor. California. American Eden. These last pocket relics of Jurassic Forest. A world like nothing else on Earth. Maidenhair flips through the booklet of questions, though Adam has asked her not to look ahead. She shakes her head at some naivete on page 3.
"None of this is going to tell you anything important. If you want to know us, we should just talk."
"Well..."
The hammock is making Adam seasick. He can't look anywhere but at the 49-square-foot country below him.
"The problem is..." "He needs data. Simple quantities."
Watchman waves southwest, the saw-whine song of progress.
"Complete this analogy. Questionnaires are to complex personalities, as skyline yarders are to..."
The woman stands with such spring, Adam is sure she'll pitch over the edge. She leans over one side while Watchman tips back to compensate. Neither is conscious of their mixed doubles maneuver. Maidenhair turns to Adam. He waits for her to plunge like Icarus.
"I was about 3 credit hours short of a degree in actuarial science. Do you know what actuarial science is?"
Is this a trick question?"
"It's the science of replacing an entire human life with its cash value."
Adam exhales.
"Could you, you know, sit down or something?"
"There's no wind at all, but fine. If I can ask you one thing."
"Okay, just please,
what can you learn about us through an exam that you can't learn by looking us in the eye and asking.
I want to know.
It'll ruin the questionnaire. He'll cue them in ways that will invalidate any answers they might give. But somehow, atop this 1,000-year-old beanstalk, he no longer cares. He wants to talk, a thing he hasn't wanted to do for a while.
A lot of evidence suggests that group loyalty interferes with reason.
Maidenhair and Watchman trade smirks, like he's just told them that science has proven that the atmosphere is mostly air.
People make reality. Hydroelectric dams, undersea tunnels, supersonic transport. Tough to stand against that.
Watchman smiles, tired. We don't make reality. We just evade it, so far, by looting natural capital and hiding the costs. But the bill is coming, and we won't be able to pay. Adam can't decide whether to smile or nod. He knows only that these people, the tiny few immune to consensual reality, have a secret he needs to understand. Maidenhair inspects Adam, as through a lab's two-way mirror. Can I ask you something else?
Anything you want.
It's a simple question. How long do you think we have?
He doesn't understand. He looks to Watchman, but the man, too, is waiting for his answer. I don't know.
In your heart of hearts, how long before we pull the place down around us?
Her words embarrass Adam. It's a question for undergrad dorms, for bar rooms late on a Saturday night. He has let the situation get away from him, and none of this, the trespass through private land, the ascent, this fuzzy conversation, can be worth the 2 extra data points. He looks away, out onto the ravaged redwoods. Really? I don't know.
Do you believe human beings are using resources faster than the world can replace them?
The question seems so far beyond calculation, it's meaningless. Then some small jam in him dislodges, and it's like an unblinding. Yes.
Thank you.
She's pleased with her overgrown pupil. He grins back. Maidenhair's head bobs forward and her eyebrows flare.
And would you say that the rate is falling or rising?
He has seen the graphs. Everyone has. Ignition has only just started.
It's so simple, she says, so obvious. Exponential growth inside a finite system leads to collapse. But people don't see it. So the authority of people is bankrupt.
Maidenhair fixes him with a look between interest and pity. Adam just wants the cradle to stop rocking.
Is the house on fire?
A shrug, a sideways pull of the lips. Yes.
And you want to observe the handful of people who are screaming, put it out, when everyone else is happy watching things burn?
A minute ago, this woman was the subject of Adam's observational study. Now, he wants to confide in her. It has a name. We call it the bystander effect. I once let my professor die because no one else in the lecture hall stood up. The larger the group,
the harder it is to cry fire.
Because if there were a real problem, surely someone...
Lots of people would already have...
With 6 billion other...
6? Try 7. 15 in a few years. We'll soon be eating 2/3 of the planet's net productivity. Demand for wood has tripled in our lifetime.
Can't tap the brakes when you're about to hit the wall.
Easier to poke your eyes out.
The distant snarl breaks off, audible again in silence. The entire study begins to seem to Adam like a distraction. He needs to study illness on an unimaginable scale, an illness no bystander could even see to recognize. Maidenhair breaks the silence.
We aren't alone. Others are trying to reach us. I can hear them.
From Adam's neck down to the small of his back, hairs rise. He's huge with fur. But the signal is invisible, lost in evolution.
Here, who?
I don't know. The trees. The life force.
You mean talking? Out loud?
She strokes a bough as if it's a pet. Not out loud. More like a Greek chorus in my head. She looks at Adam, her face as clear as if she'd just asked him to stay for dinner. I died. I was electrocuted in my bed. My heart stopped. I came back and started hearing them.
Adam turns to Watchman for a sanity check, but the bearded prophet only arches his brows. Maidenhair taps the questionnaire.
I suppose you have your answer now. About the psychology of world savers?
Watchman touches her shoulder. What's crazier, plants speaking or humans listening?
Adam doesn't hear. He's just now tuning into something that has long been hiding in plain sight. He says to no one,
I talk out loud sometimes. To my sister. She disappeared when I was little.
Well, okay then. Can we study you? A truth bends near him, one that his discipline will never find. Consciousness itself is a flavor of madness set against the thoughts of the green world.
Adam puts out his hands to steady himself and touches only a swaying twig. Held high up above the vanishingly distant surface by a creature who should want him dead. His brain spins. The tree has drugged him. He's twirling again by a cord the width of a vine. He fixes on the woman's face as if some last desperate act of personality reading might still protect him.
What are they saying? The trees?
She tries to tell him. As they talk, the war moves up the nearest drainage. The force of each new fall shatters Adam, even as it tears swaths through the remaining giants. He never imagined the violence, like a skyscraper coming down. Needle and pulverized wood cloud the air. The fall zones are the killers, Maidenhair says. They bulldoze the hell out of each landing strip so the trees won't shatter when they drop. It murders the soil. A tree as thick as Adam is tall rips away and smashes down the slope below. The earth at the place of impact liquefies. In late afternoon, they spot Loki at some distance, coming through the gutted forest, right on time to escort the psychologist back through Humboldt's blockade. But something in his forward stumble says the mission has changed. At the base of the tree, he calls for them to drop the rope and harness.
What's wrong? Watchman asks. I'll tell you up there.
They make room for him in the crowded nest. He's pale and breathing hard, but not from the climb.
It's Mother N and Moses.
Roughed up again?
Dead.
Maidenhair cries out.
Someone bombed the office. They were inside, writing a speech for the Board of Forestry Action. The police are saying they blew themselves up with stockpiled explosives, accusing the LDF of domestic terrorism.
No, Maidenhair says, no. Please, not this. There's a long silence that isn't silent. Watchman speaks.
Mother N, a terrorist? She wouldn't even let me spike a tree. She told me it might hurt the guy with the saw.
They tell stories about the dead, how Mother N trained them, how Moses asked them to sit in Mimas. Memorial service at 200 feet. Adam recalls something he learned in graduate school. Memory is always a collaboration in progress. Loki descends anxious to return to the mourners on the ground.
"Nothing we can do, but at least we can do it together. You coming?"
he asks Adam.
"You're welcome to stay," Maidenhair says.
The investigator lies in his swaying hammock, afraid to move a finger.
"I'd like to see the darkness from up here."
Tonight, the dark is ample and well worth seeing. Smelling, too. The stink of spores and rotting plants, of mosses creeping over all things, soil being made, even here, so many stories above the earth. Maidenhair cooks white beans over the burner. It's the finest meal Adam has tasted since coming into the field. The altitude doesn't bother him as much, now that he can't see the ground. Flying squirrels show up to inspect the newcomer. He's content. A stylight perched on top of the night sky. Watchman sketches by candlelight into a pocket notebook. At intervals, he shows the sketches to Maidenhair.
"Oh, yes. That's them exactly."
Sounds at all distances, 1,000 volumes, mezzo and softer. There's a bird Adam can't name, beating its wings on the blackness. Sharp scolds of invisible mammals. The wood of this high house creaking. A branch falling to the ground. Another. A fly walking across the hairs of his ear. His own breath echoing inside his collar. The breath of two others, absurdly close in this cloud village, holding their silent service. It surprises Adam, the proximity of coziness to terror. The woman clings to the artist, who works to use the last bit of candlelight. A patch of shoulder flesh catches the glow, naked and beautiful. It looks to be furred, feathered somehow. Then the inky script resolves into 5 distinct words. They wake to snarls nearer by. Men prowl the ground beneath them and farther out through heaps of wasted log, linking up their efforts via walkie-talkie.
"Hey!"
Maidenhair yells down.
"What's happening?"
A logger looks up.
"You better get the hell out. Shit's coming your way."
"What shit?"
Static bursts through the walkie-talkie. The air tightens and hums. Even the daylight begins to vibrate. A pucking sound lifts over the horizon. "They aren't," Watchman says.
"They can't."
A helicopter comes across the nearby rise. A toy at first, but half a minute more and the whole tree pounds like a tom-tom. The beast banks. Adam clings to his swaying hammock. A blast of air blows his whispered profanity back in his face as the maddened hornet rears up and strikes. Wind slams the tree, a manic updraft, then its inversion. Tops of redwoods turn to rubber, and branches slash through the canopy. Watchman scrambles up into the storage roost to get the video camera, while Maidenhair grabs a broken branch the size of a baseball bat. She climbs out on the limb closest to the assault. Adam screams, "Get back!" His words are minced to motes in the rotors. The woman locks bare feet onto the limb, which, massive as it is, flaps like rubber in this inside-out typhoon. The chopper tips and flares, and she's face to face with the machine. It noses at her. She swings her branch with one wild hand. Watchman comes behind her, filming. The chopper is big, with a bay like a bungalow. Big enough to hoist a tree older than America straight into the sky and haul it upright across the landscape. Its blades froth the air around the dangling girl. 2 humans sit inside the fiberglass pod, cloaked in visors and chin-cupping helmets, chatting on tiny boom mics with some distant mission command. Adam stares at the trick of blockbuster back projection. He has never been so close to a thing so huge and malevolent. He sees its million parts. Shafts, cams, blades, plates, things for which he doesn't even have a name. beyond the power of any human to assemble, let alone design. Yet there must be thousands of such craft, employed by industries on every continent. Tens of thousands more, armed and armored in the globe's many arsenals. World's most common raptor. Branches snap off and the air fills with chaff. Burnt fossil steams from the beast, stinking like a burning oil rig. The stench gags Adam. The roar pierces his eardrums, killing all thought. The woman flaps on her branch like a pennant, then drops her weapon and holds on. Her filming partner loses his grip in the artificial gale, and the camera, too, drops 200 feet and plinks apart. A metallic voice, massively amplified, comes out of the helicopter.
Exit the tree! Immediately!
The woman starts to shake. She can't hold long. Mimas shudders. Against all judgment, Adam looks down. Bulldozers, the color of bile, are ramming the tree's base. Men, saws, and machines prepare a fall bed right up to the edge of Mimas's burrows. He looks to Watchman, who points down at another crew working the base of a redwood 200 feet away. They mean to drop it next to Mimas. Maidenhair swings her leg back up and over the branch that bucks her. The chopper blares.
Descend now!
Adam screams and waves his arms. He yells things that even he can't hear above the insanity.
Stop! Back the fuck off!
He won't be a bystander to this death. The helicopter holds and then banks away. A voice comes from its speaker.
You're done?
Yes!
Adam screams. The syllable wakes Watchman from a trance. He looks toward Maidenhair, who clings to her branch, sobbing. No path is left but sanity. Watchman tips his head, and the occupation is over. Below, the fallbed foreman confers by walkie-talkie with his invisible network. Another burst from the helicopter.
Descent confirmed. Leave now.
The flying thing rears in the air and spins away. Winds abate. Deafening noise dies back, leaving nothing but peace and defeat. They drop by harness. The terrified psychologist, the stoic artist, then the prophetess, whose face, as she slips down the 200 feet of rope, is befuddled. They're taken into custody and led down the scarred hillside to the logging road, which has crept within a few hundred yards of Mimas's base. They sit in the mud and wait hours for the police. Then, brusque officers tuck them three abreast into the back of a squad car. The logging road hairpins down the ravine. Three prisoners glance back up the denuded ridge at the outline of that great tree, half as old as Christianity. A voice, lower than the pounding of the helicopter, says something none of them hears, not even Maidenhair. While the prisoners are being held, Patricia Westerford opens negotiations with a consortium of four universities to establish the Global Seedbed Germplasm Vault. A few filed papers, and Seedbed becomes a legal person. It's time, Dr. Westerford tells her various audiences, from whom she must raise the funds for climate control, high-tech vaults, and trained staff. Well past time for us to preserve those tens of thousands of tree species that will vanish in our lifetimes. She gets to the point where such sentences roll off her lips. In 2 months, she'll head south for a first exploratory visit to the Amazon basin. 1,000 more square miles of forest will vanish before she gets there. Dennis will have lunch waiting for her when she returns. While the prisoners mimic sleep, Nile Mehta enjoys the prime hours of creation. From his office bed, he issues a directive to Semper Virens' elves regarding the nature of Mastery 8.
What will keep several million players unable to sign off? The place must be fuller and more promising than the lives they return to offline. Imagine millions of users enriching the world together with their every action. Help them build a culture so beautiful, it would break their hearts to lose.
Halfway across the country, another woman starts a jail term all her own. The flooding in her husband's brain floods her as well. She calls 911. She rides along in the ambulance through the warm night. At the hospital, she signs the informed consent, though she'll never feel informed again. She goes in to the man after the first operation. What's left of Ray Brinkman lies slack in the adjustable bed. Half his skull has been removed, and his brain has been papered back over by a flap of scalp. Hoses spring from him. His face is frozen in terror. No one can tell Dorothy Casale Brinkman how long he might be like this. A week? Another half century? Thoughts go through her head those first nights, during her ER vigil. Terrible things. She'll stay until he's stabilized. After that, she must save herself. Again and again she hears the words she shouted at him just hours before his brain caved in.
It's over, Ray. It's over. The two of us are over. You aren't my responsibility. We don't belong to each other, and we never did.
In jail, fitful in his upper bunk, Adam sees great redwoods explode like rockets on their launch pads. His research is intact, all the precious questionnaire data gathered over months, but he is not. He has begun to see certain things about faith and law that hid themselves behind the expanse of common sense. Jail without arraignment helps his eyesight.
You see their game, Watchman tells him. They don't want the cost or publicity of putting us on trial. They just use the legal system to hurt us as much as they can.
Isn't there a law?
There is. They're breaking it. They can hold us 72 hours without charging. That was yesterday.
It occurs to Adam where the word radical came from. Radix. Raid, W-R-A-D. Root. The plants, the planets, brain. On his fourth night in the cell, Nick dreams about the whole family chestnut. He watches it, sped up 32 million times, reveal again its invisible plan. He remembers in his sleep, on the cot's thin mattress, the way the time-lapse tree waved its swelling arms. The way those arms tested, explored, aligned in the light, writing messages in the air. In that dream, the trees laugh at them. Save us? What a human thing to do. Even the laugh takes years. While Nick dreams, so does the forest. All 900 kinds that humans have identified. 4 billion hectares, from boreal to tropic. The Earth's chief way of being. And as the world forest dreams, people converge in the public woods one state north. 4 months earlier, arson blackened 10,000 acres in a place called Deep Creek, one of the year's many fires of convenience. The burn prompts the Forest Service to salvage sell the lightly damaged standing timber. The arsonist is never found. No one wants to find him. No one, that is, except for a few hundred of the forest's owners, who converge on the sold-off groves bearing signs. Mimi holds one, reading,
Not one blackened stick. Douglas's reads, "Say it ain't so, Smokey."
Adam, Nick, and Olivia are held without arraignment 2 days longer than is legal. They're threatened